there is no other religious leader about whom there has been written a greater wealth of flowery story and so many legends of supernatural phenomena, as in the story of Christ, Gautama, according to the elaborate traditional account in one of the Buddhist sacred books, was conceived immaculately. His birth was accompanied by many miraculous phenomena. He was recognized at once by wise men as the divine leader of a world whose pleasures he was to renounce in order to fulfill his messianic purpose. In fact, there is a strange and somewhat attenuated analogy between the origin of Christ, who was conceived by the Holy Spirit, who thus through his identification in the Trinity may be said literally to have taken part in his own conception, and that of the Buddha, who again, according to the traditional account, quote, had become a superb white elephant and was wandering on Gold Hill. Descending thence, he ascended Silver Hill, where his future mother was lying under the watchful eyes of four guardian angels, and approaching from the north, he plucked a white lotus with his silvery trunk and, trumpeting loudly, went into the golden mansion. When Christ was born, there was, according to the Gospels, quote, a multitude of the heavenly host praising God and saying, glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace to men of good will. And he says, if we were to attempt to list parallels in the teachings of Christ and the Buddha, the list would be long indeed, as it indeed would be long to compare the ethical precepts of the two great goodwill religions. Sisters, let's get going. This is what our graduates learn within 2 weeks of leaving our hallowed halls. The Ataka Tales. Nowhere will he say the Ataka Tales are a post-Christian production. At any rate, he may have had about 6 years of wandering, then study, according to, as far as we can reconstruct, under two yoga masters. He was, in other words, trying to achieve this liberation, this moksha, followed by a period of asceticism, mortification, and contemplation, but he just did not yet arrive. Finally came the Enlightenment. Now this Enlightenment we're going to talk about, because this is Buddhism. What did he discover? Well, he discovered negatively that Hinduism is wrong, that the methods of liberation recommended by the Hindu sages are inadequate. How did he know? He tried them, and they didn't work. And as he told his followers, is there any proof better than that? He organized ascetic followers and then positively began to preach the doctrine which began as he sat under this tree. It was a tree which is held sacred, and had his great revelation. From then on he became the, always the definite article, the Buddha, the Enlightened One. Here is a passage. Well, it's a little more, but I think it's worth reading. The passage describes one of these famous dialogues. This is, of course, now post factum, to see how he treated Hinduism. In other words, how he finally convinced his people that the Hinduism, after all, he was a Hindu, he lived in India, why they should abandon Hinduism and follow him, the Buddha. This is the text. This is from the Ataka Tales. Then the young Brahmana Vasepa, he was a Brahmin by the name of Vasepa, and the young Brahmin, Bharad Varga, another man, went on to the place where the Exalted One was, the Exalted One, of course, being Bhagavad. And when they had come there, they exchanged with the Exalted One the greetings and compliments of politeness and courtesy, and sat down beside him. And while they were thus seated, the young Brahmin, Vasata, said to the Exalted One, "As we, Gautama," that's his surname, "were taking exercise and walking up and down, there sprang up a conversation between us on which was the true path and which the false. Regarding the matter, Gautama, there is a strife, a dispute, a difference of opinion between us. The Buddhists are never modest about synonyms. Wherein then, O Vasapa, is there a strife, a dispute, a difference of opinion between you? Concerning the true path and the false, Gautama, that's our dispute. The path of what? The path which leads to moksha. Various Brahmins, Gautama, teach various paths. Are all those saving paths? Are they all paths which will lead him who acts according to them into a state of union with Brahman? That's, of course, the great hope of Hinduism." Vasepa, this is now Buddha talking. And watch his logic. "Is there a single one of the Brahmins versed in the three Vedas who has ever seen Brahman face to face? No, indeed, Gautama. Well then, Vasepa, those ancient rishis," I think we're picking up the vocabulary now, aren't we? See? "Of the Brahmins, versed in the three Vedas, the authors of the verses, the utterers of the verses, whose ancient form of words so chanted, utter or compose, the Brahmins of today chant over again or repeat, that's all they're doing, intoning or reciting exactly as then had been intoned or recited, that even they speak thus, saying, 'We know it, we have seen it, where Brahman is, whence Brahman is, whither Brahman is.'" Let me insert a parenthesis here, lest I forget. "What we have seen, touched, and felt." The answer? "Not so, Gautama." They speculate, they keep repeating, but none of them dare say, "We have seen it, where Brahman is, whence Brahman is, whither Brahman is." Then you say, Vasepa, that none of the Brahmins, or of their teachers, or of their pupils, even up to the seventh generation, has ever seen Brahman face to face? And that even the rishis of old, the authors and utterers of the verses of the ancient form of words which the Brahmins of today so carefully intone and recite, precisely as they have been handed down, even they did not pretend to know or to have seen where or whence or whither Brahman is. So that the Brahmins versed in the three Vedas have forsooth said thus, 'What we know not, what we have not seen, to a state of union, with that we can show the way and can say, this is the straight path, this is the direct way which makes for salvation, and leads him who acts according to it into a state of union with Brahman.' Now what do you think, Vasepa? Does it not follow, this being so, that the talk of the Brahmins verse, though they be in the three Vedas, turns out to be foolish talk? indeed, Gautama. That being so, it follows that the talk of the Brahmins versed in the three Vedas is foolish talk. We get, therefore, a savor of Buddha's method, devastating logic. You see also, however, something behind his thinking, and the kind of thinking, by the way, that anyone, as in this case, Buddha, who abandoned his faith, always does. He stops believing. Buddha is the greatest rationalist of human history. He should be better known. And I say greatest because he has influenced the greatest number. What are the basic principles of Buddhism? Now, as we approach these basic principles, and we have occasion later on to expand on these, I would first of all like to exclude things that are not, at least as I understand, as you see when you handle this, especially with our categories, that you are in an uncharted ocean. Because nothing almost that you have prepared you for it. But at least there are certain things that are not part of his teaching. Thus, theology is not part of Buddha's concern. Now, by saying that, some have jumped to the conclusion, I think prematurely, in fact wrongly, to say that Buddhism, even Orthodox Buddhism, is at its roots, that the metaphysics of Buddhism are non-theological or atheological in the sense that they exclude, positively exclude, transcendent being. That's not true. And I say that's not true because I've read and I've made it a point to reread, especially things that are attributed to Buddha. That's not his language. He seems not to have doubted the existence of Brahman. However, between not denying the existence of Brahman and not being concerned about Brahman is a vastly different thing. Now, this is a new kind of atheism. Now, we're speaking here of Pali, of Southeastern, of the, what I consider the more orthodox type of Buddhism, which, by the way, is minority Buddhism in terms of numbers, because all the South Sea Islands and peninsulas put together, there are all kinds of them sticking out, as you know, into the Pacific Ocean. Compared to the vast 600+ million people of China. See? In other words, the bulk of Buddhism is in China. And that is not Southeastern. That is Sanskrit Buddhism, which, if anything, is polytheistic, where the poly is really meaningful. Talk about believing in gods. They've got gods to, well, all the people want and more than they need. But Orthodox, Pali, Southeastern, what seems to be the more authentic kind of Buddhism, is non-theological in a way in which the kind of atheism that we are familiar with perhaps does not quite answer the picture, though I think it is beginning to answer the picture. It is not the kind of atheism which excludes God, which even goes to the trouble of doubting him, and less still of denying his existence, but where he is, irrelevant. And consequently, theology on the orthodox side of Buddhism, or better, of Pali-Buddhism, is not part, negatively, therefore, of his teaching. his whole preoccupation positively was with deliverance. Now the deliverance, you see immediately, is something which he borrowed from the Hindu faith. And therefore, as much as he parted company with Hinduism, and he did in many ways, yet at the heart of Buddhism is a cardinal principle of Hinduism, namely that man's afterlife, or better we should insert, man's after this life, is something which is inevitable. Therefore, immortality is of the very essence of Buddhism. It isn't that he questioned immortality, or that he wanted to ensure immortality. It was to ensure the right kind of immortality. And he wanted to avoid the kind of recurring, even eternally recurring, reincarnation we've seen at some length by now. He was faced with three options. The one believed by the common people among the Indians, who pretty much settled for going on into endless reincarnations, or reconstructing a kind of polytheism which had its heavens and hells for different periods in which you would be happy there, to at least postpone this coming back. Remember that? The incarnation is not usually immediately after a person's present demise. So at least to prolong that, to postpone, that's one option that he had. Or the second, the one taught him especially by the followers of the Upanishads, which indeed he practiced. And he favored being an intellectual, the first type, which was that of profound contemplation until a person, trance-like, discovers that Atman is Brahman. And then the third, which of course he devised. What is the method that he proposed? And you see, therefore, that Buddhism, as distinct from Hinduism, though it may be said to differ in its substructure of faith, rather differs in its methodology. So that we might say with accuracy that both Buddhists and Hindus, to the number of over a billion, believe in an afterlife, which is an after this life and after that life, and that their hope of salvation is to be delivered from those successions. Unlike the Hindu speculators, he began with four principles, which may be said to be the principles of philosophy, the four pillars of Buddhism. Each one of these is profound in its implications, the last of which really spells out practical, lived-out Buddhism. But the first three give its principles. And it's here, by the way, that Buddhism and Christianity have a great deal, or can have a great deal, in common, so that when you come to the fourth of these four noble truths, as you call them, Christians and Buddhists discover they have more in common than they ever thought. He called them the four noble truths. Let me briefly state each, very briefly describe each, and then tomorrow we will begin to explore each one. The first of the noble truths of Buddha is that existence, by its very nature, involves suffering. This is more than just a platitude. It is, for Buddha, the description of human existence. Man is born to suffer, and the to suffer is, I'm not that sure of my grammar here, is that are there such things as final clauses? There are, aren't there? He is born in order to suffer. That's the purpose. So that, now notice he is dealing with this level of existence. There are all sorts of just fantastic possibilities in this. But on this level of terrestrial reality, on this level of the kind of human existence with which we are familiar, the only kind we have, other beings no doubt have their levels of existence. Their planets shall we call them, or places of habitation. But at least all that we know about human existence, terrestrially conceived, means suffering. Second principle. What is the cause of this suffering? The cause of this suffering is something which is intrinsic to man. Now this is saying a lot, because by saying that, almost immediately, you see, he is already cutting himself off from the moorings of Hinduism. Because the caste system as conceived among the Hindus is non-existent among the Buddhists. So there is something intrinsic to man, and therefore if we could distinguish, and this may sound a little strange, but we could say that in Hindu thought, suffering is metaphysical. In Buddhism, suffering is psychological. Now the suffering and the sad lot in life in which a person finds himself, and even Brahmins among the Hindus have their troubles, well, that's something which has been preconditioned, predetermined. It is somehow something which is outside of them. It is something which they are to take. Now at this point, it makes a huge difference, and by the way, we're dealing with human minds thinking for thousands of years, almost 30 centuries, and all minds in many ways think alike. You have here two vastly different ways of looking at suffering. For the Hindu, man's lot in life is to take it. For the Buddhist, it is to be rid of it. Now, of course, the riddance is possible only if the cause is something which he can somehow dispose of. According to the Buddha, the cause of suffering is desire. Human volition is at the source of all suffering. We'll examine this as we go on, but just to see that it's because of the things we desire, or the way we desire them, that cause suffering. Incidentally, not a shallow truth. Third principle. If the cause of man's suffering in life is not ultimately something which is so predetermined that it is the very existence in which he finds himself, but it is something which is due to himself, indeed his volition, then the way to escape from suffering is gradually, and of course it's a gradual process, is to be rid of one's desires. Now when we use the verb rid, we're talking our categories, because as we'll see, this is much more complex and subtle than to say rid. As a matter of fact, in more than one dialogue, he was asked by his followers, how can you get rid of the things that you want? Therein lies both the mystery and the complexity of Hinduism and Buddhism. Then, and this is where he ended, and where we will begin tomorrow, to be rid of desires, you are to follow the Buddha's Eightfold Path. And you will see immediately you have here four used twice. Once alone, one in its first multiple. Four is a sacred number in Buddhism. For obvious reasons, there are, at the roots or foundations of Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths, ending the fourth being the Eightfold Path. All this, one brief commentary, we will not begin to examine these now, all of this is to be done alone. Others help, community there are some assistance, but deliverance, and here I am using, and I will be using, Pali, Buddhism, all of this is to be achieved, this deliverance, alone. In other words, the mukta towards which he, or what finally became the nirvana, which a person achieves when he is finally delivered, is something which is done by the person by himself. And one of the reasons, just historically, why there was such a strong reaction against this, which I believe, and scholars in general believe, to be authentic, original Buddhism, is because it allows for no help from some kind of transcendent being. Thus, prayer, as such, is unknown in this type of Buddhism. That's why Zen Buddhism, at least, as known to most of us, as much as we know about Zen, prays only by reflecting on the self.
This concludes Father Hardin's talk on Buddha and the Four Noble Truths. On the next tape, Father speaks on the Eightfold Path of Nirvana.